Welcome to another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast, brought to you by Courtroom Sciences. Dr. Steve Wood, excited about today. Two great friends of the podcast are on to talk about several factors. We're going to try to make sure we jam a lot of content in for you today. But first and foremost, introduced to Shane O'Dell. Shane O'Dell from Naiman Howell out of Fort Worth. Shane, how are you?
I'm doing well, Steve. Happy to be here. Glad to be joined by you and Mike.
Best. Yeah, and I think, Shane, this is the first, I know you've been on the podcast several times, but I think this is one of the first times I've actually had you on the podcast. I mean, you and I talk a lot offline, but it's going to be fun to have you on the podcast today.
Yeah,
and then obviously we have Mike Bassett from the Bassett Firm out of Dallas. Mike is a well-known individual on the podcast, has his own podcast as well, which if you don't, we'll make sure we plug that for you, Mike, at the end. But Mike, thanks for being on the podcast today.
Man, I'm honored to be here. And unlike Shane O'Dell, I really do appreciate it because I wore a tie.
Yeah. Yeah, you're showing us up already.
is it Judge Wood or Judge Bassett? No tie.
Your honor.
So, like I said, I appreciate you guys being on. And I know like it's a lot of ground that we want to cover. You know, all three of us have kind of talked before about several topics. And, you know, I want to call them kind of misperceptions, misconceptions, and maybe just really just kind of different ways to do things from the defense bar that I want to cover today. You know, but really, I mean, first and foremost, what I want to talk about more so than anything is, you know, reptile theory. There's been a lot of conversations throughout the years about reptile theory, and there's been a lot of thoughts about what really reptile theory does and the goal of reptile theory. And we hear often that the defense bar talks about reptile theory is to scare the jury. That's the point of the reptile theory. And Shane, I want you to talk to me a little bit about, is it really the goal of reptile theory is to scare the jury, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, you hear a lot about scaring the jury or angering the jury, making them mad. And I don't think that's the driver. I think that's an element of what's trying to be done. It may be a byproduct of what really plaintiff counsel is trying to do. But ultimately, I think what they're trying to do is really empower the jury and tell them you've got this super important job. And they do, but they have this super important job to change an industry and to make a statement and to tell this defendant that they can't keep doing the things the way they're doing them, or to make the world a safer place. I think that's really what the focus is.
Yeah, Mike, what do you think? I mean, what has been your experience? I mean, how many times have you heard probably from colleagues or at presentations that reptile theory is about scaring the jury?
Yes, and I think that is the pedestrian thought process on the reptile. And in all honesty, probably 8 or 10 years ago, I would have said the same thing. It's all about angering the jury. But having watched the reptile theory, not only in discovery, but during trial, my experience has been, to use the word that Shane did, it's used to empower a jury. And while a jury may not be happy, what I see good plaintiff's lawyers doing is setting a jury up to make a difference. And we talked about this last week when we were visiting about the show. I think one of the things that drives some of these big verdicts is juries are disappointed. Shane, I'm disappointed in your client that they didn't do X. I think disappointment may be a first cousin to anger, but they're disappointed, and their verdict is going to show that disappointment and tell you, the defendant, that what you did is not right and it needs to change. That's been my experience.
Yeah, and I think that's been what I've seen too, is, and you can just see it in opening statements and closing statements about how they're doing it. You know, going back to what Shane said about the ability to change an industry, that's not about scaring them, right? That's not about spreading the tentacles of danger, as they would say, into the community. It's more or less about making sure you have the ability, almost you're empowering the jury to be, you know, defenders of community safety. And that way they feel good about not only righting a wrong for someone who's been injured, compensating someone who's been injured, but then also doing something for themselves in their future generations. So like you said, it's less about scaring them than it is about empowering them. So I think, like you said, what I want to hear loud and clear and what I want to get across, and I will tell you, I listen to a lot of podcasts, plaintiff podcasts. They do a very good job of sharing information and stuff. And I can tell you that they talk constantly about, one, their plaintiff reptile attorneys, and we'll get to the edge here in a second, should not think about that, about scaring the jury. And in fact, they kind of laugh at the defense bar, that the defense bar thinks it's about scaring the jury, and they would love nothing more than to keep that thought process, because then it changes your tact, right, Shane? If you're thinking about scaring the jury, if you're thinking about approaching it that way versus worrying about whether or not it's empowering the jury, you're actually looking at the wrong place. And it's a red herring that plaintiff's bar would love for you to be looking at versus what you should really be focusing on.
Yeah. Scared, angry. It's almost like those are very volatile emotions and they can pivot the other direction very quickly. I think it's a lot less predictable for the plaintiff's bar to try and rely on those kind of emotions. You know, the word disappointment is a big word for me in my life with my kids and when I was a kid with my parents. And it instills this idea that there was an expectation and an understanding that you knew what you were supposed to do, and then you fell short. And so that's really where, if you empower the jury in opening as a plaintiff and you tell them they have the ability to change an industry, and then they set you up to not be able to achieve the things that are expected of you on a general every day-to-day basis as a corporate citizen, that's where the big numbers come from.
And I think we are seeing these big numbers that requires some real thinking. And I don't think you get those big numbers by 6 or 12 people all frothing at the mouth, Steve, because think about it. None of us do our best higher level thinking when we're really angry. At least I don't. You've got to be more cold and calculating. And that's where I think you're getting these outsized verdicts. And that's what I'm seeing.
Yeah. And I think to your point, and Bill Kanasky and I have talked a lot on the podcast and the papers that we see jurors on a weekly basis make, like you said, Mike, cold calculated decisions, not based upon being pissed off, not based upon, you know, irrational thinking, but more rational thinking that they see as they go through and look at the conduct of the defendant. You know, and I want to go to that about the conduct of the defendant. So while we're talking about, you know, reptile theory, I also want to pivot to reptile's been dead since 2019. I know we still talk about it and stuff like that, but reptile theory in and of itself has been dead since 2019. It's now the edge. So hopefully the defense bar, when they're talking about it now, is talking about the edge approach versus the reptile theory approach. You know, Shane, I want to start with you as far as the different tactics that have been used. You know, before in reptile theory, it was all about risk, safety, danger, harm, needlessly in danger, unnecessary risk, all that type of stuff. But the edge is a little bit different, right? The edge approach is a little bit different in the things that they focus on. So I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the edge really is kind of honed in on foreseeability, which we all know is an element of the cause of action they're trying to push. And so, you know, where we were making up some ground with pretrial motions and able to remove some phrases that they like to rely on, like that you just mentioned, needlessly in danger, we don't know what those things mean. We can't run away from foreseeability. And so we've really got to dig in and dig deep and figure out how we handle that when their focus is entirely on this type of incident was foreseeable. You have systems in place to try and prevent those things from happening, and the system failed or didn't work. And so now what do? Now we're here in front of the jury, who they're empowering to send a consequence, not a punishment. I think that's the big difference between disappointment and anger. Is disappointment, you dole out a consequence. Anger would be a punishment, right? So now you've empowered them to dole out some sort of consequence for your behavior, even though you knew this could happen, you had systems in place. So it kind of changes the game a little bit. We have to pivot.
Yeah, Mike, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, we talk about foreseeability and systems in place. You know, I think those are a couple of things that are definitely being hit on in depositions. Have you noticed, and I've seen a lot too, when I talk to attorneys, when I'm prepping witnesses about, is he a reptile attorney? And a lot of attorneys nowadays say, no, he's not a reptile attorney. And they're focusing on a lot of other aspects. Have you noticed the shift away from that, those words, to more of this foreseeability, this systems, and how have you kind of seen that play out in your depositions?
Yeah. So the short answer is yes, you're not going to get unreasonably endanger people. I'm not seeing those, but hearing those buzzwords anymore. What I am seeing are lawyers that will work backwards from the crash. So they're not going to start with the crash. They're going to start when that driver was hired. What were your systems and processes in place? What did you do? And at times, Shane, give me your thoughts. You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. If you have systems and you don't follow them, there will be consequences for that. And then plaintiff's lawyers will say, well, you didn't have a system in place for X. What did you think was going to happen? And what I see good plaintiff's lawyers doing is walking the jurors through all of the steps from when that driver came on with the company, when that piece of equipment was put in the stream of commerce, when that condition existed, leading the jurors to the quote unquote inescapable conclusion, of course there was going to be a wreck. This driver should have never, ever been behind the wheel. And that's what I see it playing to. And it really is a very logical exercise. Really, I think they take the emotion out of it. At least that's been my experience, Shane.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it puts you in that quandary of, if you have a system and it fails, then they're going to logically conclude that that's why the accident happened. If you don't have a system, then they're going to go get an expert to say that you should have a system. And you could have known that that was reasonably foreseeable and that you should have had something in place. And so, you know, you really have to pick your path and then figure out how to handle it and unpack that.
You know, it made me think of, I think we were talking when we were visiting last week. I have heard some plaintiff's lawyers here in Texas speak, and I know that Shane has heard these talks. All they do is take the cases where a passenger vehicle rear ends a tractor legally parked on the side of the roadway. That's the fact scenario they want. Because a lot of plaintiff's lawyers think, well, if a tractor trailer is parked legally on the side of the road and my client runs into the back of them, surely the plaintiff is going to be more than 51% responsible and there's no case. And these plaintiff's lawyers say, no. We're going to go back and we're going to go back to when that driver was hired, when that equipment wasn't serviced. And we are going to let the jury believe that, but for those systems failures, my client plaintiff drifts off the roadway a bit and there's nothing there. And they are having success in that model, Shane.
Yeah, you're right. And they go back to the why, right? Why was your tractor parked on the shoulder? What could have been done to prevent that tractor from having to be parked on the shoulder? And depending on the circumstances, you get all kinds of different reasons for that. It was a maintenance issue. It was a training issue. They didn't go to a safe haven, or maybe they were taking a break.
Or they weren't trained to. You know, they'll make the driver as much of a victim as anybody else, Steve.
Yeah, that's what I've noticed too, right? If you can loop the driver in, then if anything, you dogpile on that. And then essentially the driver becomes an innocent victim. I mean, how many times have you guys seen where both the company and the driver get named, and then it's almost like, hey, driver, I'm not coming after you. Don't worry about you. I'm coming after your company. They didn't train you properly, right? Don't you wish they would have provided you more training? Don't you wish they would have told you more stuff? And if they would have done that, you wouldn't have been in this position, right? So it's almost like it's getting the driver to kind of turn against the company to say, yeah, you're right. You guys hung me out to dry, and I was the innocent victim in this as well.
Well, and I've often said, a lane change case with a driver that makes a bad decision is not near as sexy as a case where a driver's brakes failed or there's a systemic failure. That, I think, is what can really put bells and whistles on a lawsuit. Because that's what a jury can understand, is a corporation making a series of decisions or lack of decisions that lead to a known result. Remember, when the trial starts, everybody knows how the story ended. They all know. The person sitting in the wheelchair, the young mother sitting there without a husband, they know how the story ends. And now they're just looking to see, how did we get there?
Yeah. And I think that goes to, Shane, that we've talked about too, about motives, right? Mike touched on it a little bit. It goes to one of the other things on the edge kind of process is pulling out motives. And a lot of times, if you've probably seen, focusing on how much would it have cost to add this conspicuity tape on the back? What would have been the cost of that? What would have been the cost to send them to a little bit more training? What would have been the cost to do this, do that, with the implication that the company is then putting profits over safety and trying to save money. So there's your motive there, is doing the things that are improper to save money and save the bottom line, right?
That's right. Yeah. And they also take different approaches depending on the growth of the company. And they like to talk about the driver shortage and that you may not have hired these people had you had a better pool or more people that were willing to drive a truck. And so you have various motives, but they do like to go back to money as much as they can and break it down and show you how little it would have cost for you to make a change.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one other thing too, I want to talk about that too, is I'm going to notice how much you guys have seen, starting with Shane, How much have you seen now with the whole pleasantries of what's your name, you know, where'd you go to school, how much education? Have you seen that kind of thrown out the window now, where you've seen a lot more plaintiff attorneys diving right into these facts about foreseeability and motives and system failures, where that's the front part of it, where they don't waste time on the other stuff?
Yeah, you know, it used to be 90% of depositions were state your name for the record, tell me about your background, where you came from. I think it's about flipped now. It's about 90% of them, they start right out of the gate with some hot topic, try to catch you off guard. And when I do prep, I'd let the witness know that they might ask about your background, but I don't start there, for the very reason that I think if you're going to be prepared for the worst, the hardest question right out of the gate. And a lot of people are using that tactic now. And, you know, if your witness isn't ready for it, it certainly catches them off guard. And then I think you and Bill have written papers about the amygdala hijack. Whenever that happens right out of the gate, you're scrambling.
Yeah.
Your witness is scrambling. They're not thinking logically. They don't remember to take a deep breath, relax, and think about the question. Listen, they're not listening to the question anymore. And so you have to have them ready right out of the gate. Mike, are you seeing that a lot as well?
Yeah. When a deposition start with, Mr. Wood, let's talk about how this trucking company put you in a bad piece of equipment. Okay, right?
Yeah.
All right, so that's what we're going to talk about. And if you've got a driver, and Shane and I have seen this, that feel horrible about an accident. They feel horrible. And they are looking for some justification as to why it happened. If a plaintiff's lawyer can give them that, I have seen it. I've seen them take the bait more than once. And that's how they start. It's not, where'd you grow up? Let's talk about how this company sets you up to fail.
And I think that go ahead, Shane, if you want to add on to it.
I'll say absolutely. I think, you know, driver mental health to me has always been a kind of a pet project and a super important thing for me. I think it's overlooked in a lot of cases. I think we always run every juror, everybody runs to the plaintiff, to the victim, to the family, but our drivers, you know, this is their daily driver. This is their job. They're wanting to go home to their family at the end of the night. And so when you have those appeals at the beginning of a deposition to potentially point the finger at anything else and give them an out and make them feel better from a psychological standpoint, it's something that you need to be prepared for, and they need to definitely be prepared for.
Yeah. And I think there's not enough, and we've talked before on the podcast, but I think both of you guys bring up really good points that bears repeating, is, like you said, driver mental health isn't something that's not focused on enough in the deposition training process. And that a lot of times you'll have drivers say that they're fine, that they're not dealing with anything, but truth be told, their profession kind of is predicated on being tough and being people who are unflappable. But the truth of the matter is, there's a lot of stuff that's boiling under the surface. And more you peel back those layers, the more and more you find out that they are dealing with stuff. I mean, I've worked with drivers before that say they're completely fine, and by about hour four, then they start seeping out that they have PTSD. They've been thinking about it. They've been thinking twice about whether or not they want to drive truck. But, you know, a few hours earlier, they ever said they were completely fine. So I think when you're dealing with drivers in those situations, you can't just gloss over the mental health aspect.
No,
the driver,
and you're so not going to get them to open up to you if you've never met them and you see them 30 minutes before their deposition. You've lost. And I know Shane knows this. You start establishing rapport with that driver the minute you get hired, because they've got to learn to trust you.
That's right.
Once they trust you, then you can start to see what is going on with them. But if the first time they've met you, they come to your office, they've never been into the big city, you come out and take them into a conference room, and for 30 minutes you talk to them, that's a recipe for disaster. And sadly, that's still happening.
Yeah. And I think one other thing too, on top of that, I don't know how you guys feel about this, and I think this goes to more or less about doing things differently and kind of informing the defense bar. I mean, have you seen it before where companies, trucking companies, are not necessarily talking much with their drivers, finding out how their drivers are, what's going on with the litigation? So a lot of times it feels like the driver's kind of like, this whole litigation's in a black hole. And then all of a sudden, before you know it, they're getting notified for a deposition and they had no clue what's going on. And they tend to be a little bit pissed off at the company, right? Because the company hasn't really been keeping them informed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say this, I was just explaining this to a young associate here in my office, and I tell them, we have two clients. They may be aligned, but we have two clients, and you need to spend as much time with your driver as you spend with the company. You have a lot more documents to go through with the company and a lot more things to talk about. But in reality, you really don't. You need to learn about your driver, their person, their family, where they're from, what makes them tick. Because like Mike said, if you meet them 30 minutes before deposition or before prep even, you're already behind the eight ball, because you're going to ask them to do, to listen and to trust you in the deposition. Say, trust me, if it's not an appropriate question, I will object and I'll tell them that you're not going to answer that. Well, do I trust this guy I just met, or do I trust the guy that I've known for 6 months and that we talk about, you know, you're building a house with your grandfather or your kids and how they're doing, and just really digging in. You know, there's a lot of human element to this job. And when we miss that and just go straight for the litigation steps, we miss out on a huge piece of what makes people credible.
Yeah. And I think the plaintiff's bar does a really good job of that, right? Is spending time with their plaintiffs, learning about them. But I think at the same time, Shane, that was perfect, that you need to spend more time talking to the drivers and the defendants.
And we need to be able to stand up in front of the jury and say things like, you know, I was talking with Mr. Smith, my driver, last night over his kitchen table. Because plaintiff's lawyers say that stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And like, we can't do that. You know, I was visiting with Mr. Smith, you know, in February when he and I were together out at the accident scene, and we went and got lunch and we were talking about this. We have got to do better at that and let the jury know that this is our client. And just one other thing, I think the power of tactile and touch, and when you're talking about your driver in front of a jury, I think putting a hand on their shoulder means a lot, because you are saying this is with whom I'm associating.
Yeah. And I think that's a good segue, Mike. I want to start with you is when we talk about humanizing the corporation, humanizing the defendant. I mean, we've already just kind of touched on that, but like, I know that there's some approaches that a lot of people take as far as humanizing the corporation, humanize the defendant, where they talk about how many people work there, what their, you know, how much they donate, how much, you know, philanthropy they do, and all these different things. But I think they probably lose an opportunity to really humanize the corporation, humanize the defendant. So, Mike, I want to start with you. Is what do you see as the way to do it properly versus the other way?
Well, I think the way not to do it is to stand up. And how many times have we seen this voir dire or this opening? Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for paying attention to me during jury selection. This is the part of the trial called the opening statement. It's a lot like a dust cover in a book. And at that point, the jury, you've lost them. You've lost them. So I think one of the things that I'm talking with a lot of lawyers here is it's three bullet points. Be brief, be bold, and be gone. Get up, say what you're going to say. Be bold about it, be passionate about it, and then sit down, because you're going to start to train the jury that, hey, when that Shane dude stands up, the dude with the beard, we got to listen, because he's up, he gets his questions answered, and then he sits down, and they're going to pay attention to you. And I believe we cannot win these cases back on our heels. We need to have a story that we are telling from the jump. And I think we've got to do that. The first 30 seconds of jury selection, the first 30 seconds of opening statement, and the first 30 seconds of closing argument, that's real estate you're never going to get back. So don't give it up with that kind of stuff. At least that's my hot sports opinion, Shane.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. We live in the era of TikTok and reels, right? You don't see a 30-minute reel or a 30-minute TikTok video. It doesn't happen. You have to use that precious real estate right at the beginning to capture their attention and tell them what's so important. I think the same thing is true for cross-examination. I think the same thing is true for direct. If you get them up there and you introduce them to the jury and you walk them through the 4,000 degrees that they have and that they've been a surgeon for 25 years and done this surgery 1,000 times. I mean, I've started front loading those questions with, do you think this accident caused this injury? No. Was this surgery necessary? It wasn't. How much should it have cost? $20,000. Are you aware they've charged something in excess of that? Oh yeah, definitely. And then you can go back and unpack it, but you got to front load it. You're dealing with a whole generation and a whole world of 30-second to 1 minute clips.
So I guess, Shane, how do you prep for that? I mean, I'm sure it takes a lot of preparation on the front end to do your opening statements, because, you know, there's been times that I've watched, whether it be on CVN or even in our own mock trials, where some people will say, I have to go for 2 hours. There's just way too much information for me. I have to go for 2 hours. I have to go for 3 hours. I can't get it concise. I mean, what do you say to that? I mean, I think if you spend time in preparation, you'll probably get it down to a little bit more concise and find your bullet points, right?
That's right. You have to spend more time on the front end in order to do it. There's efficiency and conciseness require a lot of preparation. It's not easy. You can't just go in and cut straight to the meat and get rid of all the fat and trim it all off. You've got to do all that before you get in there. Tried a case a few weeks ago, and the judge said 10 minutes for closing because it was late and he wanted to get it to the jury. And the plaintiff lawyer about lost his mind. And I said, I'll do it in 10 minutes. That's perfect. I don't want the jury to get mad at me anyway. I need to be concise. So I think anytime somebody asks for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours for opening or anything else, I'll let them have it, but I'm going to take my 10, 15 minutes at most and talk to them about everything I can get into that time frame.
But it may take 12 to 20 hours of working on an opening, Steve, to get a 12-minute opening.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that so do you have a process in place other than, you spend a lot of time, do you revise and look at here, okay, can I cut this out? What can I use there to be more concise here? How do you kind of do that for those listening who like to do the 3-4 hour opening statements? What advice do you have for them of ways that they can use it?
All right, so we didn't go over this, but here's my answer. First off, if you've got a case that's going to be taken to trial, and frankly, these days, if you do what Shane and I do, I had a claims adjuster tell me today, Shane, on the call, $1 million policy is like a 30-60 policy was 5 years ago. Okay, if you've got $1 million policy in the cases we handle, that's just, so run of the mill. I'm never going to get up in a case of any consequence and give an opening statement that I have not tested in a focus group and tested themes and see what resonates. Because one of the things we as lawyers do, we can get so far in the weeds and we start to breathe our own exhaust and we think we have found the silver bullet in a case, only to have a focus group or a mock jury tell us, that meant nothing to us. This is what was important. So my first answer is, Steve, you got to work with professionals to help you do it. And then second, you've got to kill your darlings. Like Stephen King says, write it all out if you want, but keep stripping it away to its essence. And I'm real big on 3 points. If you can make everything 3 points, you're going to keep that jury with you. And you mark them. I'm going to tell you 3 things, 1, 2, and 3. Number 1, number 2, number 3. Remember these 3 things. Thank you. Sit down. Which, at least in my experience, that's what resonates with jurors. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah. Trying to get your opening into 3 things is what takes 12 to 20 hours, like Mike's talking about, and trying to figure out what those 3 things are and also trying to anticipate how they're going to flip the 3 things on its head and make me look silly for having those as my 3 things. But I'm with Mike. I can start writing out a script. And let's assume it's not a case that I can focus group or the whoever client carrier doesn't want to pay for it. I will sit here in my office and have people from my office that don't know anything about the case listen. I will bounce questions off of everybody that I can bounce questions off of and say, hey, I want you to poke holes in this, flip this theme on its head and turn it around and make me eat it so we can figure out what they're going to do with it. So, you can focus group some of that stuff internally, but Mike's right. You start drinking your own Kool-Aid and you think you've got the right thing. And we did a focus group years ago where the whole case was about Bluetooth and it was all about distracted driving. And the whole focus was this guy's on his Bluetooth and he was distracted and his reaction time was slowed. So we hammered it in the first focus group. We hired the right experts. We hired the best and the most expensive guys we could find. And they nailed it. Well, at the end of the focus group, those 3 panels were like, man, we wanted to hear about more than the Bluetooth was done. The first witness, it was over. You guys kept talking about it. You move on. We want to know why you didn't do these other 4 things. And we were, okay, well, it was a good thing we did the focus group because we were so hyper-focused on the Bluetooth that we needed to pivot. We had definitely hit that nail on the head, but we had already hammered it into the board. So we need to move on to the next topic and develop those.
Yeah. And obviously at the sake of sounding self-serving, I think you guys both bring up a point though. I mean, I think it goes to the value of the focus groups on the mock trials, right? Of not drinking your own Kool-Aid, seeing what works and what doesn't work, and then using it actually as an opportunity to say, okay, you know, here's all this information that I have. And we're doing a lot more of these kind of early focus groups now, you know, pre-mediation and very early on in the life of the case. It's like, okay, here's all the things that we think we are important. Let's throw it to the jury. Let's see what they think. And then let's distill it down. I think is a good way to do that.
And here's a little inside baseball. Every plaintiff's lawyer with his or her salt is focus grouping their cases multiple times.
Yep.
It's just, that is just the reality.
Oh, absolutely. I was listening to some of the podcasts, and they're talking about flash focus groups where they just take a little short clip of their client and show it to some people that they've recruited and say, give me three words of your impression of this person. Do they come across as credible or honest, or do they come across as, you know, evasive? I mean, they're testing things often, and they don't usually ask questions even in depositions that haven't been tested. And so from that perspective, I think we've got to step up our game in a lot of different ways, but we really, really, really need to be testing these things with potential, you know, other people that would be sitting in the juror seats. Obviously not these jurors or those jurors you're going to have, but you've got to know what the average ordinary person thinks and not the guy that's been behind the curtain the whole time trying, you know, looking for that silver bullet and thinking you found it when you completely missed it.
Yeah, I think it goes to, I mean, when you think about plaintiff ask and what they're asking for, do you think they just pulled that number out of thin air? No, you can guarantee that they focus grouped it. How much can I get away with, right? Is this too low? Is this too high? Where's my sweet spot? And sometimes I think the defense bar, when they're thinking about alternative damage numbers, sometimes I feel like, I mean, and I don't know what your guys' experiences are on that, is the thought that's going into the alternative damages number needs to be tested as well. Is this way too low? It's going to piss the jury off. Is this too high? Where's the sweet spot? But then also at the same time, how do we justify it? Because as you guys know, offering up alternative damage number as just some random number when they ask why is because that's what I want to pay versus having some explanation for it, right? I mean, Mike, well, what have been your experiences as far as that? I know we didn't get a chance to talk too much about this, about counter anchoring, but I mean, that's another thing too you have to put thought into.
Yeah, I'm all about it. It used to be years and years ago when I was being trained how to try lawsuits when dinosaurs were roaming the earth. You never, ever, ever put a number out there. You just didn't do it. And now you've got to. I think you have to have a number, but I also think you need to give a why. Mm-hmm. This is why I think it's a fair number. Now, they may not agree with you, and that's okay, but I think that's better, Shane, than them going, that dude just stood up and threw a number out there. He's just trying to lowball us. That's all he's trying to do. I think that's the worst thing that can happen with a counter anchor.
That's exactly right. You've got to have a logical basis that you can explain in less than 10 seconds as to how you got to that number. If it takes you 2 minutes to explain it and you need a whiteboard, you got to come up with something else, because they're not going to follow you. But, you know, Mike, to your point, you know, the old adage of never throw out the number, never throw out a number. I think that's had to change because we're trying cases with clear liability more often than we ever were before. Mm-hmm. You know, previously clear liability, you'd work it up, you get it resolved. And now the plaintiff's bar is trying to push some of those clear liability cases for big numbers. And if you don't give them a number to counter anchor on, then sometimes they might give an award that is shocking, but they think they're doing you a favor. Yet they just have no idea because their perspective hasn't been properly adjusted.
Yeah, they don't know. It reminds me of a story. My wife took a photograph of a small container of tea, and she sent it to one of our sons and said, get this for me at the store. And it was like the size of a Lipton tea bag, but it wasn't in perspective. So my son was going through the store looking for a big bag and he couldn't find it. Well, the fact was he didn't have any perspective. So a jury hears $15 million and they don't know, they have no perspective. So I think it's our job to give them perspective. And also on that, I think that we have got to be able to not apologize for what we are doing, if that makes sense. We can, you know, we can take responsibility. And I think if we need to, we should, because it's a race to credibility. But I think the minute we come across or viewed as apologetic, I just don't know if that does our clients any good, Steve. And you and Kanaski do the research. I just don't know if that does us any good.
No, and I think one of the things I'm seeing a lot more too, you know, and you guys are the legal minds, not me, but I've seen plaintiff attorneys use that sometimes too, where they talk about how long it took before they finally admit responsibility, right? They only admitted responsibility on the eve of trial, ladies and gentlemen, so that it's a game that they're trying to use in order to drive the number down. They didn't admit responsibility until we went through all this litigation. I mean, I guess, how do you handle that type of stuff, Shane? If I'm sure you've had it happen to you too, where that happens.
Yeah, that timeline, it can come back and hurt you, you know, when they get that in and talk about it. You know, this has been going on for 2.5 years and you just admitted liability last Friday. And so you've got to be prepared for that, and your witnesses have to be prepared for it. And if you're going to admit liability, you need to be ready for that kind of argument and explain why it happened that way and provide some context. Again, perspective is so critically, critically important. Without that, they're just in a vacuum, hearing only what they've heard in front of the jury for that time period in the courtroom. And it can be dangerous if you don't provide some context.
But remember, that happens on the other side too, and we should not shy away from the ability to utilize that in our favor.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, on the perspective topic, you know, this goes back to another issue on these clear liability cases, whether you concede or you admit liability. You know, I've had cases where we have made changes internally as a company, and my clients have made changes to their approach or to their policies. And we've at times rolled those out to the jury, because if the plaintiff lawyer is telling the jury that here they are, they're empowered to change an industry or change the way this company operates, one way to kind of disarm that is to say, you don't need to teach us a lesson. We've already fixed it. We realized that there was a problem in the system and we fixed it. And if you're conceding liability already, it's not like you're any worse off on question one on the charge, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something to consider. And so long we've fought subsequent remedial measures, they're not admissible, don't talk about them, keep them out. But on these clear liability cases, sometimes it can serve to give the jury that perspective that they may otherwise miss.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And that goes to, you know, I want to close the loop on kind of the humanizing the corporate representative and the humanizing the corporation, Shane, on how you think the better way to do it is, as far as how you should be sending that message to the jury and whom through should you be sending it through.
I think credibility is a big issue. You want them to be credible. You want them to answer direct questions, not dodge the issue. You can backfill with being a great corporate citizen. You can tell the story some, but again, that real estate right up front is so important, not only on the corporate side, but I would say your driver needs to be humanized too. People oftentimes don't associate truck drivers with that being their occupation, just as you and I go to an office every day. They hop in their truck and drive. When they park it and go home at the end of the day, they go home to their family, they eat dinner, they do all the things that we all do. That just happens to be their job. And so showing that perspective to the jury for both your driver and your company is just critically important. But you have to do it efficiently.
Efficiency is definitely the key. And keeping in line with efficiency, I'm going to wrap up this podcast because I want to stay efficient. But I do want, Mike, I do want you to have the opportunity to plug your own podcast. I know that you have a podcast that I listen to. I think you have a lot of great guests on there. So talk to us about what your podcast is, and then also how can people reach out to you if they need to get a hold of you?
You know, you're very kind. I don't think anybody's ever asked me about my podcast except family members. It's called Legal Grounds, Conversations on Life, Leadership, and Law. It's on all the platforms, and there's a lot of folks from the legal space in there, but then leaders in other industries, military leaders, restaurateurs, people in the entertainment industry. And it's really a conversation over a virtual cup of coffee about what people are doing to make the world a better place. So if you've got 45 to 52 minutes and you want to feel better about yourself when you walk away, tune in.
Yeah, and Mike has a very soothing voice too, so very, very relaxing. And what about you, Shane? Yeah. If anybody wants to get a hold of you, you know, reach out to you, anything, they have questions about potential projects or potential clients or any of that stuff, how they reach you?
Yeah, email, phone call. I mean, I have my email, sodell@namandhowell.com, and I've got my cell phone on me at all times, and I don't mind sharing that, 817-992-6431. But I will say I subscribe and listen to Mike's podcast, and it is fantastic. So everybody should tune in and listen.
We're going to let Mike go before he gets too big of a head on this, right?
No kidding. I'm just waiting for Kanaski to come on into this Zoom room and just smack me down.
Yeah. I thought he was just moving closer to the camera.
He'll catch wind of this, I'm sure, and you'll hear about it. He won't be as nice and as generous as me. Like I said, Mike Bassett from the Bassett Firm, Shane O'Dell from Naaman Howell, appreciate you, both of you guys being on. Always enjoys talking to you both on the podcast and outside of the podcast. Appreciate all the insight you provide me professionally and here on the podcast. So this has been another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast, brought to you by Courtroom Sciences.